Welcome to the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Support for the Archive Project comes from A to Z Wineworks, offering cool climate wines that capture the essence of Oregon since 2002. This episode features an hour with Siddhartha Mukherjee from his talk as part of Portland Arts and Lectures in 2017. What is astonishing about Mukherjee is that he had become both one of the leading medical researchers in the world and also a Pulitzer Prize-winning author before the age of 45. He is also trained as a singer of classical Indian music to boot. Mukherjee was born in New Delhi and has lived in the UK, now making the US his home since about 1998. His first book, The Emperor of All Maladies, A Biography of Cancer, was an international bestseller and quite possibly helped forge a new genre of nonfiction. This was followed by Gene, An Intimate History, which in many ways serves as a prequel to the first book by describing the history of genetics. It also functions as a kind of memoir tracing mental illness throughout his family tree. His level of mastery of both writing and science is breathtaking and is part of what makes Mukherjee an utterly unique voice in American literature. Let's listen as Mukherjee tells us the story of the gene, opens a door in its future, and suggests the implications that this research will have on human evolution. Here's Mukherjee.
Thank you. If the entire sequence of, say, your genetic code was written in the form of a book printed as a standard size font, that book, that volume of books, would occupy about 70 full sets of the Encyclopedia Britannica. So downstairs in this part of the hall, a lovely place, every wall would be lined with the 3 billion odd letters that would make up your genetic sequence. Now, what's interesting about that is that if you picked out one of these volumes, it would read A, C, T, G, C. There are only four letters, A, C, T, G, C, T, C, C. So it's not a very amusing book. But, and here's what's astonishing, and we've forgotten how astonishing it is. The first cell in your embryo knows how to build you out of that code. It gets more astonishing. So the difference between you, sir, and you in this volume of Encyclopedia Britannica is between two human beings, look completely different from each other, different stories, different life patterns. The difference is about two volumes, three volumes. The difference between you and your sibling, who has a lethal neurodegenerative disease called Huntington's disease, would be about four pages in that set of Encyclopedia Britannicas. The difference between you and your sister, who has cystic fibrosis, a disease that will almost certainly change her very identity, is three letters in that Encyclopedia Britannica. The difference between you and someone who has a hereditary capacity to develop a certain cancer might be one letter in that code of codes. So I usually begin my talk with reminding us that that's what this code is about. And if you don't have a capacity to be stunned by wonder about what that is, then we've lost some idea of what wonderment itself is. We can't not be struck by wonder about this. Then I raise a couple of important questions. I'll raise two or three, and I want you to think about them. You don't need to answer them by raising your hands. But the first question is, if I were to tell you that, in fact, that five-page difference between you and your sibling with Huntington's disease, if I were to tell you that, in fact, I've devised now, as we have, a genetic test that will test for that propensity to develop Huntington's disease, 100% chance that your unborn fetus will develop Huntington's disease if, in fact, that genetic test turns out to be true or positive, would you choose to carry that child? So the second question is, let me just bring the odds slightly, make the odds slightly different. What if I were to tell you that a similar kind of test in the near future, in the next 5 years, would allow us to diagnose a child, again an unborn child, with a 60% risk of a very, very debilitating form of autism? How many people would choose not to carry this child, a 60% risk? And the third question is, what if I decrease that risk now to 10%? So 10% risk of carrying a diagnosis of a child of having severe debilitating autism, 90% chances that this child will never have this in his or her lifetime. How many people would change their minds about what they had decided before about the child with 60% risk? These seem like abstract questions. The Huntington's disease question is not abstract at all. That is a concrete question. The other two, I would argue in my book, and I would think that in the next decade, these questions will become extremely concrete for each and every one of us who chooses to have a child. They become very concrete for us. So with that sort of somber background, the question is, why did I write this book? I wrote this book because my own family has a crisscrossing history of a disease that we know is genetic, but we don't know what the genes are, schizophrenia. I had two uncles who succumbed to schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, one cousin who's permanently hospitalized, and this has now moved on to a third generation in my family. And the question that I begin this book with is, I have two daughters. They're 11 and 7. And put yourself in these shoes, put yourself in your own shoes, and ask the question, would you choose, if this set of genes, probably unlikely to be one gene, but the set of genes was identified, gene variants that had this predisposition were identified, and you had two daughters, would you choose to sequence their genomes? And question number two is, what would happen if only one of them, these two daughters, ended up carrying this mark that would predispose you, maybe again with a 20 or 10% risk in their lifetime? Would it change the way you think about these two children who are otherwise completely healthy now? So that's the reason for this book. If you're interested in that question, these questions, and I suspect that we all should be, that's the reason that I started writing this book. Cancer was very much part of this. Cancer is a genetic disease, so it was part of this idea behind it. It certainly was propelled by cancer, but genetics is not an abstraction for me. It is one of the most concrete realities that my family has faced, and I would argue it is one of the most concrete realities that virtually every family in this room will have faced. So. What I want to do here is I want to take a little bit of a journey. I'm going to take a detour into cancer and back to remind us about how powerful genes have been in our understanding of that disease and how helpful they have been. But I also want to take a long journey into the history of heredity, what we understand about it. I want to end that journey by bringing you close, up close, with what is going on in the world of genetics and biology in general today, which really brings us to two themes, and I want to end there. Theme number one is that we have acquired in the last 5 or 10 years, if you haven't heard the news, we have acquired the capacity to deliberately intervene on the human genome. And the capacity, in principle, the possibility that we could intervene on the human genome in a permanent manner, in the manner that that genome would be replicated and carried on into multiple generations. In principle, we've acquired this technology. And number two, in principle, and actually more than in principle, we've acquired the capacity, the technology, to sequence entire human genomes. and to predict very powerful things, not everything, but very powerful things about the future from those genomes. I'll give you two examples. The future risk of cystic fibrosis, so the future risk of Huntington's disease, which will absolutely change your identity, your fate, or of the person carrying these future risks. So I call this reading and writing in genetics, reading the genome, writing the genome. And in the next decade or so, we will develop, I suspect, the final capacity, which is to write this code of codes, A, C, T, G, C, T, T, C, C, so forth, 3 billion letters of it, from scratch as a chemical. And so these three things, reading, writing, and ultimately recreating a whole new language, I suspect will become technologies that our children will deal with in a manner that will make the current technological concerns, Facebook or whatever, Uber, seem absolutely trivial. They will seem absolutely trivial because we will be manipulating, we'll have the capacity to decide or not to decide to manipulating human genomes and thereby changing what it means to be human. So let's just talk a little bit about how we ended up here. Heredity is a question that obviously was one of the first perennial questions. It's a question as old as human beings themselves. Why do we look like our parents? Why do we look unlike our parents? What does likeness mean? And how is likeness transmitted between generations? And there were lots of ancient theories. One idea was that, you know, every human being was contained in a kind of homuncular form inside sperm. And the female, the woman, was just kind of a bag of nutrients. There have been stranger theories than even that, but nonetheless, it was like blowing up a balloon. You just added water, and out would come this human being locked inside sperm, tiny. But that, of course, couldn't possibly be true, because as even Aristotle noted, shockingly, some traits actually were inherited from your mother. So that couldn't be true. The next theory, which actually stayed for the longest time, seems very intuitive to begin with. There's a great deal of intuitiveness about that theory. But if you really think about it, it turns out to be quite counterintuitive. So the idea was that your mother and your father transmitted features, likeness, and you were a kind of wearing blender that mixed up these features. And the fact that the color of your eyes or your height was an intermediate between your mother and your father was just the result of the fact that you had blended together these two features. Now, of course, if you think about it, that makes no sense, because how would you explain that you have two genders? Why is it that in every generation, basically, the two genders don't blend together and you have some intermediate form? Obviously, that couldn't possibly be true. And if you thought about that idea, the fact that there are two genders and they have different anatomy, you have to conclude that there has to be some things, the information has to be passed out in a form that does not get diluted. It doesn't get blended up, as you might imagine paint getting diluted and blended. It has to be carried in some kind of discrete form, otherwise every two generations we would end up with hermaphrodites. That idea was actually vocalized a couple of times in the ancient world, but never really found purchase, never really found important purchase. Until a man who was a monk experimenting, who failed biology, by the way, so there's hope for all of us. this monk who decided that what he would do is he would take pea plants and breed them with each other. And he made sure, the one thing he was very careful about is that he made sure that the plants that he was breeding were purebred to start with. So he would take a plant that was always breeding purple flowers, was always breeding white flowers, and he mixed them with each other, or he bred them with each other. A plant that already always had yellow seeds versus green seeds, and he mixed them together, he hybridized them, made offspring, And to his surprise, but of course, if you know this now because you know that we're not all hermaphrodites, that to his utter shock, he found that the traits that were generated in these plants were not blended forms, were not intermediate forms. They either went one direction or the other direction. So that was his first experiment, but had he stopped there, it already would have been important. Had he stopped at that place, it would have been important. The second experiment, he then bred these so-called, and this is actually a scientific word, bastards. He bred these intermediate forms, and to his utter surprise, to his utter complete surprise, he found that the trait that had been lost in that generation, so the flower color that had the white flower color that had disappeared, suddenly popped up again. And if you think about that, you don't have to worry about laws and ratios, although he was very concerned with laws and ratios. If you think about that, it's got to be true that that trait, whatever it was, that piece of information, could not have been diluted out. It had sprung back again in the third generation. And if you thought about that, you had to make the argument that this information was being carried in a kind of particulate form, like an atom, like an indestructible form that wouldn't be diluted over generations, but was carried intact over generations. And that, of course, was the first idea of the gene. Mendel, who worked in this monastery, didn't coin the word gene. In fact, the word gene would come years and years later, but he had discovered its essential features. Mendel read his paper out to a group of about 70 farmers at the Agricultural Society of Brno, and I suspect all of them fell asleep because the paper is basically not mentioned for another 30 odd years. It vanishes. It vanishes from the scientific literature. And he essentially, Mendel himself, lost interest. 30 years of being ignored does that to a person. And Mendel himself lost interest, and he basically went on, became a relatively successful administrator. And he forgot it. And at his death, but if you read Mendel's obituaries, they remark on many things. But I picked up a nice phrase, which is the phrase that opens this chapter. It says, right at the end of his obituary, he talks about him as a monk, as a teacher, et cetera, et cetera. No mention of his experiment. And it said, you know, he really loved flowers. It's a nice idea. So 30-odd years pass, and all of a sudden, three scientists independently, also working with hybridization, also working with these materials, begin to realize that information is transmitted between parents and offspring in this particulate form, in the form of particles. And they've written their papers. They go back to once you finish a paper, you go back and put in your references. And to their utter shock and dismay, they find that all these experiments that they had done had been done about 30 years before by this monk named Mendel. So I write in the book, being rediscovered once is charming. Being rediscovered thrice is an insult. So Mendel was rediscovered three times by three independent workers, and actually subsequently by many, many independent workers, and they all stumbled on the same idea, that information was moving in this particulate form. And so this brings us up sort of this is the turn of the century, early 1900s, and it was an English physician named Archibald Garrod, who has the best mustache of anyone that I have ever had a photograph of in my books. Archibald Garrod made the argument that this wasn't some weird, unique phenomenon that was sitting in the plant world, that in fact there was something about this phenomenon that was true for humans. So Garrod was a physician, he was a pathologist, and Garrod published an incredibly important book called The Inborn Errors of Metabolism, in which if you leaf through the actual insides of the book, you'll suddenly find Garrod making the following statement. Number one, he acknowledges that like Mendel, these traits, these characteristics must be moving across generations in this intact form. And number two, he also begins to realize that the form, this whatever this thing is, by now called a gene, whatever this substance is, it's giving rise to a chemical variation in humans. So that's a very bold statement that Garrod made. He realized that whatever was moving across generations was giving rise to chemical variations, and in fact, he uses the idea of hair. He says, look, the difference between your hair and my hair is really a chemical difference. chemicals that make one hair versus another hair. But the information that's passing between you and your offspring is not the same. It's not hair itself. It's not the chemical of hair, but it's some information that specifies the chemical of hair. It tells the embryo how to make that particular kind of hair, and the embryo then makes that particular kind of a hair. So he called these chemical attributes, and he said the gene is not that. The gene is not the chemical attribute itself. It is the information to make that chemical attribute. And if you thought about this, Garrett further made the claim that when that information goes wrong, if there's some difference in the information, variations in the information might lead to different chemicals between different human beings. That causes normal variation. And if that variation happens to impinge on a process that's important for living, you get illness, you get pathology. So the inborn error of metabolism was a chemical error. That's why some kids were born with in the incapacity to digest sugar and died at, you know, 1 day or 2 days. Other children were born with an incapacity to do some other chemical function, but the error was in the information itself. A very, very important idea, the transmission of information giving rise to chemical variations and the difference between normal variations and disease itself. Now, if you thought about that carefully, you would understand that that leads to a very dangerous place in history. If the information was not discrete, if the information was all spooled together, like a continuum, like a tape recorder, like a physical tape, or like a vinyl disc, if it was all spooled together, then it would be very difficult to pull one piece of information outside from the other. It was all part of a big whole. It would be very hard. But if the information was not spooled together, if it was discrete pieces, something that would specify the color of hair, something else, a discrete other piece, that would specify the way your nose was built or the way the color of your eyes were built or emanated, then what if you, if it was discrete like that, what if you began to say, well, I'll take this piece and take that piece away. I'll reject that piece. I'll allow human beings to have this one particular feature or characteristic because I'm selecting that piece of information that I like. And in doing so, I can reject human beings that have other pieces that I don't happen to like. And if you think about that idea, that leads to eugenics. Eugenics was an infection that was born in, for the most part, in the United Kingdom. The word was initially coined by Galton, and the idea was that you could select, because this information was discrete, you could select favorable traits, reject unfavorable traits, and thereby create a race of human beings that was superior to the one that you were able to manipulate in the first hand. Long before it metastasized to Nazi Germany, it would come to the United States. If the eugenics was born in the United Kingdom, its real adolescence, where it gained the most strength, was in the United States, was in this soil. There's a story in this book. The book is dedicated to this woman, Carrie Buck. Carrie Buck was one of the first women to be sterilized as a consequence, because she was thought to have carry a genetic propensity for imbecility. None of that would end up being true if you really look through her records. But it was a pretext. This is her mother, Emma Buck. Both of them were confined in Virginia in a state colony. They were both confined, and Carrie Buck would be sterilized and so that her genetic lineage would be terminated, and she would no longer bear any children. The one child that she had, unfortunately, died at a young age, and she was not allowed by state mandate to carry her lineage forward. And the famous judgment delivered by Oliver Wendell Holmes was three generations of imbeciles is enough. So there sat the field in this rather dark place in the 1930s and 1940s as millions of people were carried out in Europe, moved to gas chambers to eliminate their genetic heritage. I wanted us to remember this story as we move forward into thinking about what happens into the future. I'll come back to this story as we move forward. So the question, going back to the science again, going back to Garrett again, was what is the basis? How does this information actually get transmitted? How does the gene contribute to the chemical variation or diversity in humans? So you can imagine this as the question: what is the structure of a gene? What molecule carries it? What does it look like? And what is the function? How does it manage to transmit that chemical variation, the chemical diversity that Garrett and others had identified before? So Rosalind Franklin was, as many of you know, a brilliant scientist who took the photograph that would ultimately lead her and Jim Watson and Francis Crick to realize that that molecule, the molecule that carried genetic information, that was written in these four letters, ACT, GCT, CCCT, so forth, was in fact this double helix. It's been described by many biologists, starting from J.D. Bernal, too, as the most beautiful molecule ever created. And here it is in Cambridge, the solution of this is the first structure of the double helix, and these are representations. So it's two helices wrapped around each other. They're mirror images, as it were, of each other, a kind of yin and yang structure. This structure, one of these helices, determines what the other one is. So they're completely complementary to each other. And here you see the code, T, C, G, A, C, and so forth, wrapping around. And as I told you before, let's pause for a moment in wonderment to realize that there are 3 billion such units separated out in humans into 23 chromosomes. And the first embryonic cell knows how to build you from that code of 3 billion ACTGZ and so forth. So how does it know? How does that cell know? Well, it knows, again, going back to people like Garrett, it turns out that the gene creates a message, and that message is ultimately translated into the form and function, into those chemical variations that Garrett had identified. Again, the details are you can read about them in greater depth in the book. But we know actually what those chemicals are. The gene is carried in the form of DNA for most organisms, virtually all organisms. It is then made into this message, carried in the form of RNA, which is ultimately translated into a protein. RNA and protein are really the determinants of regulation and function of cells, and they determine the form and function of human cells, ultimately building, as I said, I put this picture up on purpose, Jim Watson, Sidney Brenner, the differences between this person are partly related to the differences, again, in the code being translated into various variations in form and function. I'm summarizing vast swaths of molecular biology, but we need to have this vocabulary. Let me convince you that we need to have it because we're going to start talking about things that will become extremely relevant to ourselves, our families, and our children in a second. But if you want to talk about that, we just need to have this vocabulary. If you don't have this vocabulary, you won't be able to participate in this conversation in a meaningful way. So we just need to know this this information. So, onwards. So by the 1970s odd, scientists had figured out that this was the basic structural organization of information. And then two things happened which led us a little more deeply into the next phase of discovery. And this is the sequencing and cloning of genes. And this brings us to the edge of the reading and writing that I was talking about. Fred Sanger was a biochemist, a chemist in Cambridge, whose work lots of other people contributed, but whose work really seminally led to the possibility of reading that code. Before this week, I could tell you that there was a code, but I had no way of reading what the actual code was. Sanger's methods, actually, which are still used today in some modified form to sequence entire genomes of human beings, that method really came from Fred Sanger's work, and he figured out how to read the actual genetic code. So now, for a bacteria or a yeast, and subsequently for much, much more complex organisms, you could read the ACTG. You could actually enumerate exactly the content of those 70-odd sets of the Encyclopedia Britannica. So this is reading. But of course, we still didn't have meaning. We don't know the meaning of this reading. It is, you can read that, you can read and enumerate, or you can find exactly what the code is, but you wouldn't have the, you wouldn't know how to understand that code. That'll come in shortly. And at the same time as Sanger, another series of experiments was performed that allowed us to now begin to change genetic information in organisms. This is an astonishing series of experiments that were really borrowed from the microbiology world, the world of bacteria. And just to give you a flavor of how strange and extraordinary it is, bacteria live on the rough edges of life. They're on the wrong side of the tracks all the time. So because they're so much pressure, because they have so much pressure to survive, they are constantly fighting battles with other microorganisms, particularly viruses that invade bacteria. And one thing that bacteria have evolved over millennia is the capacity to, when a virus invades it, the bacteria chops up the DNA, the information, essentially paralyzing the information that the virus is bringing into the bacteria. So it has a capacity to chop up this information. And separately, all organisms separately need mechanisms when their DNA breaks. Again, the information's lost. When their own information's lost, they have to find a way to put it back together, to string it back together. Now, if you think about that in terms of information theory, there are really two separate functions. There's a cut function and a paste function. And if you now think about this chemically or biochemically, what is to prevent us to cut a gene of a human being, human DNA, and paste in a piece of a goat DNA, for instance, using the same tools? So that was a thought experiment, but very soon was not a thought experiment. That was actually done. And in the 1970s, you can actually see that. That's what's nice about this picture. This is Herb Boyer and Bob Swanson working in San Francisco. And here in this picture, they have a thing called a plasmid. You don't need to know what that is. Then they have a thing called synthetic DNA, another piece of DNA. And here, very merrily, they've opened up this thing, cut it, and inserted this piece inside it to create a molecule that does not exist in nature, a new piece of DNA that does not exist in nature. And others called it recombinant DNA, combining two pieces. And you can begin to imagine, if you put this into, and you can make a million copies of this inside another organism, that would be referred to as cloning. And all of a sudden, you begin to realize what the power of that technology is. The power of that technology is, what if I was to say, let me put a snake toxin, or a gene that specifies a snake toxin, I'm making it up, I'm hypothetically, into a bacterium that inhabits the human gut? Or what if I was to take, just to give you the flip example, the gene that makes insulin, a vital substance, medical substance, medicine, and put it into a bacterium and make insulin instead of going and harvesting insulin from, 1,000 pig pancreases or 1,000 cow pancreases, waiting, killing 1,000 cows, mashing up the pancreas and extracting insulin. That was the only real way to make insulin before, hence bovine insulin or pig insulin. What if I just made it using genes? I put the gene for insulin and put it inside a bacterium or another cell, another kind of cell, and just had the cell make insulin. Once you exchange the genetic information, it becomes completely translatable. It's not as if the gene knows or the cell knows, oh God, that piece of DNA came from this organism, I'm not going to touch it. That's for the most part true. And so there you have the capacity to now take information from any organism and mix it and match it with information from another organism. So this is beginning to write DNA, to read and write DNA. Obviously, the scientific world didn't take these ideas without the requisite amount of seriousness. It was very, very clear that this needed to be handled, that we were on the capacity, we were on the brink of something extraordinary. And Paul Berg, my first mentor, scientific mentor, Sidney Brenner, Maxine Singer, Norbert Zinder, organized, along with several other people, an enormous conference. And this conference was an open conference. They invited journalists, they invited people from the world of bioethics, people from the world of biosafety to ask the question, we've arrived at this place. Help us figure out what to do next. And this led to a series of important restrictions, self-regulatory restrictions that scientists imposed on ourselves to thereby ensure that this information would not be used out of control. Now, what's important about Asilomar is Asilomar was extremely strong on biosafety, so preventing, you know, rogue organisms from being leaked out, poured down a sink. You know, your bacterium with the snake toxin, by mistake you're turning around and you pour it down the sink. It was very good about proposing appropriate regulatory restrictions on that. It was very poor because they hadn't anticipated proposing restriction on what to do once we started manipulating human genomes. We'll come to that idea in a second. So the last part brings us up to where we are today, because this is the post-Asilomar world, and that is entering the world of human genomes, human genetics, and really asking the questions that I had posed in the beginning. So one of the things that these new technologies, cloning, sequencing, allowed us to do was to take those very diseases that we knew were genetic and identify exactly what were their the genes that were causing these diseases. And as you can imagine, the first ones to be solved were genes, were diseases where there's one gene which one gene that determines whether you will develop the disease or not. So-called monogenic diseases, one gene diseases. This is one of the most striking examples, one of the first such diseases to be mapped to its appropriate gene. This is Huntington's disease, work done by several people, including Nancy Wexler. Here she is in Venezuela, where there was a family hugging a young boy who has Huntington's disease. This is one of the family trees. You can see it crisscrossing through multiple generations with Huntington's disease. And Huntington's disease was one of the first diseases. And if you, again, let's not fail to appreciate what impact this kind of analysis can have. Huntington's disease is a disease where you don't know that you have the disease until you've already had your children. So it's you carry it, but you don't know your propensity for it until you have your children. So that's one of the reasons it persists in populations, and it's a lethal neurodegenerative disease. So just imagine the impact of this technology. All of a sudden, in the span of a few years, you have the capacity to test yourself for it. You have the capacity to test a child for it. You have the capacity to test a fetus for it. And imagine how quickly that would change the way we think of ourselves. Imagine how it would change what we think of this one particular disease. So the first diseases were, predictably, Huntington's disease, cystic fibrosis. And then it was very clear that many other illnesses had genetic components to them, but they weren't single genes. That multiple genes interacted with each other to give rise to genetic components. And the idea was that the only way we would begin to figure out, although certainly classical genetics would help, but the only real way we would begin to figure out is to solve the entire human genome, all 3 billion letters of it, going back to that reading project. And that was an enormous project. It was launched in the 1990s. And by 2001, at least the draft sequence of that genome had been completed. Now you had the real encyclopedia, that normal template along which to organize this information. So once that was known, simultaneously, we began to appreciate that things weren't as simple as they had been anticipated. So there wasn't a one-to-one correspondence between genes and their functions. So there's some important features here. One feature is that the human genome, we realized, behaves more like a recipe than a blueprint. Now, in a blueprint, there's a one-to-one relationship between the drawing and what happens in the actual form. So you say a widget goes over there, that widget actually gets blown up and put into that place, and there's a one-to-one correspondence. a recipe, of course, is not doesn't have a one-to-one correspondence. You don't say that, you know, when you mix flour and butter and sugar, you don't say the flour goes over there and specifies that part of the cake. It's part of a process. And so the human genome behaves, for the most part, like a recipe, although there's certainly widget genes in the human genome. And then it brought home, the sequencing of the human genome brought home an idea which had actually existed for a long time in the literature, which is that genes, multiple genes, even multiple genes, cannot unilaterally determine the fate of many features. In fact, that you required genes plus environments plus chance. In fact, the genome in some ways is like a lens through which the environment and chance are being refracted with each other. And there are many examples of this in the book and elsewhere. And importantly, that the genome had this capacity that I described to you before, that it has the capacity to generate the astonishing amount of constancy that we share with each other. The fact that we all have essentially an anatomical plan that is consistent between human beings, but also has the capacity in the few volumes, in the few letters that are different between you and me, the capacity to generate the astonishing amount of variation that we experience as human beings. That, by the way, is my one, I don't like to plug my books, but that's my one plug. In these political times, please read the chapters on race in the book. Because the word has been so manically distorted that I hope that genetics can knock some sense into a nation that's gone mad about a word that has very little genetic reason. I was going to read that section. It's quite long and quite provocative, and you can imagine what the conclusion is, that the Victorian construction of race is entirely arbitrary, and the fact that we are fighting about a scientific construction that's largely arbitrary is really embarrassing to me. But anyway, I'll let you read that piece. So the last part, I want to concentrate on the questions that I raised in the first part of the talk, which is where are we? How do we butt up against these technologies? Well, two kinds of technologies are of concern. One is the capacity to introduce new genetic information into human beings. And one way you could do this is to introduce that information into cells that will now carry this genetic information inside the body. These cells might even reproduce inside the body, but they won't transmit the information to another generation. So this is so-called somatic gene therapy. Somatic because it's carried in your soma, in your body, but it's not carried in your germline and will not be transmitted. So if you think about it, modifying a blood cell or a blood stem cell, the blood stem cell will reproduce in your body, give rise to blood, but it won't be transmitted in the next generation because obviously blood doesn't become sperm or eggs and will not be carried forward. And so that is somatic gene therapy. The second form takes us even more into really new territory. So this is discoveries again made from the microbiological world, from bacteria, which I'm sure all of you know about today, which is the capacity using technology that's borrowed from the microbiological world to make deliberate changes in genomes and potentially deliberate changes in the human genome. So just to drive that point home, again, imagine this lower auditorium filled edge to edge with those 70 volumes of the Encyclopedia Britannica. For until recently, we had no mechanism. We could read that encyclopedia, but we had no mechanism. If you said to me, go to volume 17, page 347, and erase the three words that spell ACT and make them into GGG, there was really no way of doing that. But this technology, CRISPR-Cas9, other variations of this, essentially allow us to do that, to delete potentially and with a little less capacity to change the information. So you could say, well, what's the big deal? Well, what if those three nucleotides happen to specify the gene that carries the risk of cystic fibrosis? What happens if those 10, 15, 20 nucleotides happen to carry the risk of breast cancer or increase the risk by 10% of autism? These are the questions that I'd asked you for a reason at the beginning of the talk. So we have now come up, we have abutted ourselves to technology that allows us, in principle, to make deliberate, defined changes in the human genome. And if we combine these technologies, in principle, these changes could become transmissible from one generation to the next. And if we do that, then we, of course, are changing human beings deliberately in the future. Now, I hope I have convinced you that this is technology that our children will be debating and talking about in a way that will make much of these current debates entirely trivial. It'll become entirely trivial. This is, it gets to the question of why we will do these things, what is allowed, what is not allowed. So the important piece of this is that the National Academy of Sciences, 3 weeks ago, issued a directive asking these questions: what should be allowed and what should not be allowed. I'm going to leave you with what the National Academy decided, and then let you think about it. I'm going to read one page of the book. So the National Academy of Sciences said, look, the simplest one, the simplest category, is if you want to make these changes in the laboratory. We're doing this. Virtually every laboratory is doing this. I'm sure people are experienced. It's shockingly easy to use. The first thing is, you know, should we make these alterations in the laboratory, potentially even in embryonic cells, human embryonic cells? And the Academy said, yes, we can allow that within the bounds of reason, within the bounds of biosafety. You know, you don't flush a new bacterium you've made down the sink, et cetera, et cetera. But these bounds have been known since Azelamar, so that's the easy questions. And they said, go ahead, really not many restrictions there. The second, now we know the vocabulary, the second is with respect to somatic gene therapy, so changing the genes in the soma of a human being, blood cells, blood stem cells, muscle stem cells, etc. And the Academy said, again, within the bounds of reason, as long as we understand how to do that safely, that should be permitted, and in fact, those trials are already ongoing right now. So changing the blood, for instance, using these technologies. The final question, and it was a real surprise, was should we be changing them in embryos, human embryos? And the Academy made the suggestion or the proposition that for diseases that involve truly extraordinary suffering, that in fact we should be, for the first time, we should open up the possibility of doing this in a human embryo. So that's the thought that I want to leave you with, which is that's where we are today. Should we go forward? What will happen? Remember, we've barely swallowed the history of our own eugenic efforts. On the other hand, the possibility of removing from the human genome forever potentially lethal vulnerabilities that we've accumulated, the capacity to cure diseases, and finally, the capacity to completely rewrite all of this from scratch, reboot from scratch. Created a piece of DNA that was entirely from scratch, you could then write whatever you wanted to into that, is a question that looms largely over us. I'm going to end with returning. I'm going to read three paragraphs from the last part of the book. What force or mechanism might explain such widely divergent fates and choices of individual human beings? In the 18th century, an individual's destiny was commonly described as a series of events ordained by God. Hindus, for instance, had long believed that a person's fate was derived with nearly arithmetic precision by some calculus of the good and evil acts that he or she had performed in a previous life. God, in this scheme, was like a glorified moral tax accountant, tallying and divvying out portions of good and bad fate based on past investments and losses. The Christian God, capable of inexplicable compassion and equally inexplicable wrath, was a more mercurial bookkeeper. But he too was the ultimate, if more inscrutable, arbiter of destiny. 19th and 20th century medicine offered, then, a more secular conception of fate and choice. Illness, perhaps the most concrete and universal of all acts of fate, could now be described in mechanistic terms, not as the arbitrary visitation of divine vengeance, but as a consequence of risks or exposures or predispositions, conditions, and behaviors. And choice was also understood as an expression of an individual's psychology, experiences, memories, traumas, and personal history. And so by the mid-20th century, ideas like affinity, temperament, preference, identity were increasingly described as phenomena caused by the intersections of these two things, psychological impulses, personal histories, and random chance. An epidemiology of destiny and choice was thus born. In the early decades of the 21st century, we are learning to speak yet another language of cause and effect in constructing a new epidemiology of self. And that is, we're beginning to describe illness, identity, affinity, temperament and preferences, and ultimately fate and choice in terms of genes and genomes. This is not to make the absurd claim that genes are the only lenses through which fundamental aspects of our nature and destiny can be viewed, but it is to propose and give serious consideration to one of the most provocative ideas about our history and future, that the influence of genes on our lives and beings is richer, deeper, and more unnerving than we had imagined. This idea, of course, becomes even more destabilizing and unnerving as we learn to alter and manipulate the human genome intentionally, thereby acquiring the ability to alter future fates and choices. I have often thought about the possible trajectories of members of my own family, my uncles, my cousins, if they'd been born in the future, say 50 or 100 years from now. Would our knowledge of their heritable vulnerabilities for mental illness be used to find cures for those diseases that had devastated their lives? Would that knowledge be used to normalize them, in quotes? And if so, what moral and biological hazards would that entail? Would such forms of knowledge enable new kinds of empathy and understanding? Or would they, in fact, enable new forms of discrimination? Would the knowledge be used to define or redefine what is natural? But what is natural? On one hand, variation, mutation, change, inconstancy, divisibility, and flux. And on the other, constancy, permanence, indivisibility, and fidelity. It should hardly surprise us that DNA, the molecule of contradictions, encodes an organism of contradictions. We seek constancy in heredity. We desire it, and we find its opposite, variation. Mutants, as it turned out, are necessary to maintain the essence of ourselves. Our genome has negotiated a fragile balance between counterpoised forces, pairing strand with opposing strand, mixing past with future, pitting memory against desire. It is, by definition, the most human of all things that we possess. And so its stewardship might be the ultimate test of knowledge and discernment for our species. Thank you very much.
That was Siddhartha Mukherjee speaking at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall in 2017. This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from the Archive Project, subscribe on iTunes. Support for the Archive Project comes from A to Z Wineworks. Join A to Z Wineworks and help make this podcast and all our programming possible. Give today at literary-arts.org/donate. Our show is produced by Crystal Liguori for radio and podcast. Special thanks to the Literary Arts Board, staff, and community. This show would not be possible without them. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.